What happens when a former art professor turned doctor of metaphysical sciences and philosophy decides to go to Brazil and discovers a Templar symbol on a cave? Yes, play the John Williams music. Because in a story as riveting as the Da Vinci Code, and much less disappointing than your experience watching Angels and Demons, you will learn so much about the Knights Templar, ancient hidden orders, what was really going on in South America, as well as spontaneous healings, flames, energy, ley lines, the Ark of the Covenant, Holy Grails, Mary Magdalene, the origin of the word Portugal. Dr. Kathleen Ann Ball joins me, Greg Bornstein, on a very weird, which I guess makes it very normal, Open Loops. Your conscious mind needs the rest, because your unconscious mind is ready to shake it down. You're now tuned in to your favorite late night talk show for the shamelessly fringe. It's Open Loops with Greg Bornstein. Conversations that bend. Today on Open Loops, we have Dr. Kathleen Ball. She is a researcher, traveler, an explorer of ancient sites, and we're going to be talking about something very interesting that I did not know about until I happened to, coincidentally, bear my eyes on Kathleen's work, which in a weird way is a metaphor for her discovery, which is that there's a cave hidden in a remote area on the outskirts of a small Brazilian town. A cave carved by the Knights Templar. We'll have to unpack all of that, as well as perhaps some of the other things you've uncovered. But first, Dr. Kathleen, thanks so much for coming on the show.
You're very welcome. I appreciate you asking me to come on, and I'm really, I enjoy discussing the research. I enjoy discussing the Templars. And, the new discoveries that are coming out, because there's a lot of new information that's coming forward now. A really wonderful time for researchers, because things are just coming up all the time. So I'm excited. I'm really excited that I'm able to be here in this time frame. And
Were you always out there doing this field kind of exploration work?
Well, in a way, I was an art professor, and so my day job was teaching art, fine art, sculpture, anatomy, all that stuff, and multimedia. Anyway, so on the summers, and during the summer and my winter vacation, I would take off, and I started back in 1990, 91, 92, all the way through 94 and 5, in the Native American sites, petroglyph sites in Northern California, the Washoe tribe, Chumash, some of the other tribes up in Miwok, up in Northern California. And so that, that kind of consumed me, but it also made me sensitive to ancient sites and where they are and how to, how to notice them. Because a lot of people just walk right by these sites. They don't even know they're there, So anyway, so that kind of kicked it off. And then About 2000, I started really getting into the esoteric research. I started really getting backtracking Christianity. I was working on my second master's for world religion, and I just really dove into it. I was looking for the roots of religions, of all the religions, and
Oh, very
finding a lot
interesting.
of similarities, you know. And so eventually, of course, that led me to the Templars. And in 2006, I was invited to offer. I did a portrait head of Leonardo da Vinci. He was like a mentor to me from the other side. Anyway, I was asked to bring a portrait of him that I had done, a sculpture that I had done, to the Vinci Museum in Italy. So I took a class over there to Europe. We followed the path into. All through Italy, we dropped off the portrait. We got into Florence and, Rome, and followed all the way into Amboise, France. And there I discovered, well, let's see, at that time, the Da Vinci Code was just coming out. Right. When I was in Italy, actually, and the Pope wasn't too happy about it at the time. But I happened to be in Italy when it came out. So that came out, and I was like, okay, well, here's the Knights Templar being mentioned again, the Prelate de Sion, all these esoteric members, memberships of people, groups of people. So anyway, that sparked my interest again. So I started reading more and researching more, but I really didn't have a chance to really dig into the Templars in terms of physical research until 2009. And in 2009, my husband and I had gone to France for a month for a motorcycle trip, and just the two of us. Anyway, we ended up in Dome, France. And while we were there, the curator of the museum there handed me the keys to the dungeon where the Templars had been kept, where they were imprisoned, and said, "Bring them back when you're done." So, I went in and photographed everything. And so that's really what, if that hadn't happened, I would have never discovered the cave. I wouldn't have realized what the cave was when I found that in 2015.
Very interesting.
Yeah, so all it's really been a grail quest for me. It really has. I mean, it's just, if certain things happen, and if they hadn't happened, I would have never found this cave. I would have never. Hey, I was in Brazil. I wasn't even there researching. I was there to see John of God because I had a liver condition, and my girlfriend thought that, he could possibly do something to help me. I had a very interesting spiritual experience around that, but I didn't have a healing. So I ended up, I ended up having to have a liver transplant later that year. But so here we are in Alto Paraíso. We decided John of God was taking a break for some reason. He was off for a few days. So we decided to go up into the mountains and go find these waterfalls that are abundant in the Chapada, which is a national forest area, protected area up in Brazil, in central Brazil. It's about 3.5 hours outside of Brasília. So we decided, we're going to take a jaunt up there. And fate intervened. My girlfriend, who was driving the car, didn't really understand how to drive a car with a clutch. She burned a few clutches on the way there. So they had to keep bringing us replacement vehicles. And they finally gave us an automatic. But anyway, if that hadn't happened, we wouldn't have got up into Chapada when it was dark. And she didn't want to drive in the dark. So we ended up having to stay in one of these little towns. And I chose Alto Paraíso because I like the name. It means high paradise. And if that hadn't happened, we wouldn't have found the cave. I wouldn't have discovered the cave. All these things. It was like I was being really, truly, I felt like I was being guided. And, and then we were down at this waterfall. And on this property, it's called Agua Fria, which means cold water. We were on this property, and we came up from seeing, from hiking down into the waterfall. And the man who owned the camping posada on that property said, "Hey, would you ladies like to see this crystal vein that's on the property next door. And I said, yeah, I'd love to. That sounds wonderful. And he says, there's all sorts of crystals laying all over the place. You know, you can just pick them up. So my girlfriend Adele and I, she was with me, and she wanted to do it. So we went over there. We met with this young guide. His name is Liamar, and he's become a friend. Anyway, so we're hiking about 3.5 kilometers down this, you know, this kind of steep mountainside in the middle of nowhere. And we see this crystal vein that's running through this property, and it's about a meter high by, I don't know, probably about a half a meter to a meter, you know, in width. It's huge. It runs all the way through the property. So I'm thinking, and it's solid crystal.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking, wow, you know, and there's crystals laying all over, and it's really hot. It's just really hot. So Liamar says, well, there's a little cave just down about another kilometer if you want to just go and we can rest and have some water and just rest for a little bit. So we said, sure. So we go down to the cave and he lifts up the bushes and I just about fell over. It was a Knights Templar cross carved right above the cave. But not just a Knights Templar cross. It was the same ones that I'd seen in Dome, France in 2006.
And you're the first person to recognize this?
Apparently, nobody else has ever mentioned it, there's nobody else has documented this ever. So as far as I know, I'm the first person to have discovered this.
That's very interesting. And what about any records of any Templar activity in that area of the world? I mean, was there anything in documentation? Did this line up?
Yes, there is. I went into the Rosicrucian Library, and that's where I do a lot of research since my house burned down in 2015, you know, back up again. So I find this cave in Brazil.
Okay, okay.
Home. 9 days later, my house burns to the ground.
Oh my gosh.
All my art records, all my artwork, everything, just it burns to the ground. And 6 weeks later, I have a liver transplant.
Oh my gosh. So this is very interesting. Okay, keep going. I'm riveted by this story. I have tons of questions, but I'm going, wait a minute, this is... I'm enjoying the process of getting more questions as you keep telling me. So, okay, so you do have this liver transplant. The house burns down after this discovery. And what next?
So what it did is just completely divert my whole life path.
Yeah.
As a result of the liver transplant, I lost hearing. So I wasn't able to go back to teaching, and all my curriculum and everything was burned up anyway, but I figured I could make it work somehow. But after losing the hearing, because what happened is the liver transplant anti-rejection medications caused nerve damage and I lost hearing. So that was like, okay, I can't go back teaching. What am I going to do? And so I gave myself a year to heal. In 2017, I made the decision to go back in, rediscover the cave, film it, and make a documentary. So just changed my whole life path. And so in 2017, I go back in to rediscover the cave, and there's a huge fire in the area. Burns up all the terrain around the cave. I can't get in. No one can get in. So I have to just take another year. So, but what I did do is find a photographer who was willing to go back in, who had film experience with Jacques Cousteau. So, you know, he knew what he was doing. And so we agreed to meet the following year and go back in. So we did 2018. And that's when I rediscovered the caves in 2018. So it just, you know, it just kicked off this whole thing, and we filmed the whole thing and I brought it back. I found a producer, a fabulous production company that Unusual Accomplishments. They're the ones that produced the first film, and it's out on Gaia now. But they were just fabulous to work with, and they put it together for me. You know, I wrote the narrative, I had all the footage, and they put the whole thing together, and Gaia snapped it up right away.
Wow. Yeah. Now this is very, tell me this, I'm curious. The fires what is going on with that? Do you attribute that to some kind of spiritual experience? Were the Templars coming from afar to stop you from knowing the secrets? I mean, what that feels like it's a significant part of the story for me.
Well, it is. When the fire happened, and I actually painted this because I have a background as an artist, I felt as if it was an initiation by fire. You know, I had gone through floods, I had gone through initiation by water, and I had a near-death experience in 1990, which completely changed my life. I had a number of experiences throughout my life, and this is all in my book. I have all this in my book, but in 2015, when my house burned down, I actually visualized myself in the middle of the fire that night when we left the house. I visualized myself in the midst of the fire with it swirling around me, and everything was being changed. All my furniture and everything was being literally transmuted back into its energetic state. And I had the gift of being able to create whatever I wanted.
And
powerful experience. Anyway, I woke up and my husband and I were talking, and he says, "Well, I don't think the house is gone." I said, "Oh, it is. It's gone. I dreamt about it last night, and I'm gonna paint it. It's gone." Anyway, it was an initiation by fire, and it also supplied me with some funding as a result of the insurance and all that.
Yeah.
And to repurpose my money and not, you know, I didn't buy a bunch of stuff again. I bought a home, of course, but I was able to save some funding to do the film and to continue to continue with my research and continue to travel and photograph and film everything. So I really see it as just a transfiguration of sorts.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it definitely sounds like it. I was going to ask about, in general, the Templars, because, again, my exposure to it is what you mentioned before. It was all Dan Brown, Da Vinci Code, reading Angels and Demons. I mean, this is where you first hear about Templars and you hear about secret societies in general. You know, what is, I know Dan Brown gets a lot of flack, And I know there's some things that weren't entirely accurate, but to the best of your abilities, I mean, how would you describe who were the Knights Templar?
Well, the Templars, you know, they were mysterious. I mean, I'm finding things now that are just amazing me. The Templars were, if you really think about it, they were layered. They weren't all obviously the same. Nobody is. No group of people. I don't care. Give me a membership to anything. I don't care if it's the Brownies or a Masonic Lodge. It doesn't matter. You're not going to have a cookie cutter person. You're going to have a vast, you know, variety, a diversity of all different types of people. And that's what the Templars were. You know, they had knights. They had businessmen. They had, you know, they had farmers, they had actual masons, and they had an inner group. They also had an inner core of their spiritual inner core. And those are the people that I believe are the ones that carved out my cave, because of the symbolism that I found in the cave, which I filmed, and it'll be in the second episode.
Oh, wow.
But some of those esoteric symbols that are in there, it leads me to believe that we're dealing with a very elite, esoteric group of people. They weren't, you know, they weren't the army, you know, they weren't the crusaders. These people were educated. And they had an agenda, and I'm not quite sure what that is, but I'm digging, you know, I'm digging into the research that's available to me. But I did find out that the Templars, they were in all of many countries in South America, not just in Brazil. They were in many countries, And I ran across another book in the Rosicrucian Library that indicated that they were actually hunted and murdered by the Jesuit priests in the 1500s, all the 17th century. So there was, you know, even though Dan Brown, yes, there was a lot of inaccuracies. I agree. There were a lot of them. But there's always a tidbit of truth. You know, there's always a little bit of truth in everything. And so that's basically what I've found so far. I also found out that there was another group of knights that went all the way back to the building of the Second Temple that Zerubbabel put together. They were all Jews. They were all
interesting,
right? And then I've just recently found out that there was a group of knights that actually protected Mary Magdalene and Lazarus when they came over from Jerusalem. So I'm beginning to think that there was the Knights Templar may have been an organization created in 1118. But I'm beginning to believe that it was some of the same families that stemmed back to the ones that helped Mary Magdalene come into France, and also possibly all the way back to the second building of the temple and Zerubbabel's knights that he created to protect the builders of the second temple. That's what my research is leading me to now.
Wow.
So I'm going to be taking a trip back to Portugal in March. We're in May. And I found a fellow researcher over there, and we've dug up some really interesting, really, really interesting stuff that will be in the third episode of the Templars. And that's really, really interesting stuff. We found a port in Portugal that is very possibly the port that the Templars left out of. During the reign of King Denis, which is 1300s, indicating that the Templars may have left as early as 1290 to go into into Brazil. So this is pushing back dates much, much further than any of the historians have recognized. And I think that there's a great deal of evidence pointing to it so far. And I think that there's a whole lot more evidence that I will be uncovering as I continue this research. And it's fascinating to me. It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. I'm now wondering what you wrote your art thesis on. What was your, were you an impressionist? Was there anything that had to do with this whatsoever when you were an art professor, art history professor? Is this totally out of left field for you?
Well, I expressed my research in three dimension, painted some. I did some painting. I painted my near-death experience, you know, several times.
Interesting.
A lot of my research, my early research when I was doing the world religious, you know, I was doing my second master's for the world religion. I went back and studied the Nephilim and, you know, all the giants. I followed up on all the giants all over the world. So I depicted this in installations. I created Nephilim. I created, you know, angelic forms with daughters of men. In fact, the installation was called the Nephilim and the Daughters of Man. So that, and then I expressed everything. I went back into the Sumerian texts, and I did several sculptures on all the Sumerian gods and goddesses and the creation gods, you know, and all that. I did that. And
did you get in trouble for this?
A huge installation in San Francisco that was called Union of Opposites that I used Kabbalah Tree of Life as an understructure. It was about half the size of a football field. It was huge, huge.
Wow.
Exhibition. It traveled all over too. It traveled from San Francisco to Sacramento, all through Northern California. Parts of it went to Germany and Australia and Canada. You know, it went all over the place. But anyway, and that was my studies of Kabbalah when I was doing my studies of Kabbalah and comparative studies with the Eastern religions, Buddhism, Sufi religion, or well, Sufi belief systems, and Hindu.
Oh my gosh, you are such a perfect guest for this show. Every sentence you're saying is just another. I'm going, whoa, Dr. Kathleen Ball is deep into the esoteric here. I mean, I've done a lot of conferences and episodes of the show and talked to a lot of people that, when you bring up the Nephilim, when you bring up the Sumerian creation story, when you talk about skulls that are shaped differently than a human could be, you're not getting a yeah. You get in trouble. You get in trouble with mainstream academia. Do you feel like you had to? I mean, was any of your research causing controversy early
Oh,
on?
I'm sure it is. No one is, I've had a few people challenge me, but the research is so solid. I mean, the cave is there, the cross is there, the symbols are in the cave. I have had a current Templar in Portugal. I took all the stuff back to this fellow in Portugal, who's also a cross expert, and he is a current Templar, and he corroborated that yes, it is a Templar cross. It's definitely Templar associated with Templars, and he wouldn't, of course, want to give me a date because nobody wants to do that. But now they're all looking at the fact that the dates of that type of cross are the same as the ones in Chinon and also in Dome, France. So the tool markings are the same, even not just the crosses, but the tool markings. And so no one has come forward to dispute because there's too much evidence, I think.
Is there, I mean, what do you think they were doing in this cave?
Well, the cave was a gold mine. And that's going to come out in the second
A
episode.
gold mine.
It was actually a gold mine, and I ran a metal detector through the whole thing. So there's no gold in it now. It's been mined. It's gone now. But again, I think this goes back to King Denis in Portugal in 1300s, because the Templars, I believe, were going to Brazil and bringing back gold for King Denis. And I think that I think that they left Portugal to go into Brazil with his blessing. Also because in this small port town called Peniche in Portugal, he had a military, an order of military there that were protecting something in the 1300s, and he was back and forth between Tomar, Portugal, and Peniche, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Oh, what was he doing? What was so important in this little port town? What was so important, that he was going back and forth? So I think he was in on the whole thing. The difficulty is that so many of the records have been destroyed because the Templars were hunted. They were literally hunted, and the Inquisition in the 1500s finally encroached into Portugal. They hunted and destroyed anything that was affiliated. Anyone who was affiliated with the Templars was imprisoned and tortured, and all the records were destroyed. So the only things that I'm able to dig up now were stuff that family members held on to at the risk of death, basically. So that's what I'm relying on now.
That's interesting. What about when it comes to when you say this is your, and I know that's part of the title of your book that may or may not be out by the time this episode comes out. What is the full title of your book?
What is what?
Can you repeat? Yeah, because the book title is long, so I don't want to. It's a,
Oh, okay. Yeah,
yeah.
it's My Grail Quest and
Yeah.
Discovery of a Knight's Templar Cave in Brazil.
Interesting. I love it. I love the Holy Grail imagery. How much is this connected to this notion of a Holy Grail? I mean, Dan Brown clearly makes a connection and the symbolic connection, and even talked about how Da Vinci's pointing to it. I mean, in your estimation, what's going on with that?
Well, in my case, my Grail Quest is the real deal because not only have I found this Knights Templar cave, But as a result of that, I had to interview, like I said, the Amazonian tribes. So I went back. When I went back in 2021, I was invited. They weren't coming into Alto Paraíso because of COVID. So they invited me into the Amazon jungle, and that's where I lived with them for a week.
Oh.
And during one of the healing ceremonies, I actually had a healing. And I was on these heavy anti-rejection medications, and I'm now no longer on any of them. It's been 7 months. My doctors are absolutely mystified, overjoyed for me.
Yeah.
But one of the stories that's attached to the Grail Quest is healing. And so in my case, I literally had, and I had no intention of it, absolutely none. All I was doing was going in to interview the chief about the relationship with the Templars and the Amazon tribes, because I had a tip from one of my fellow researchers in Portugal who told me that the Templars were led into Alto Paraíso from Bahia, which is on the coast, by Amazonian Indians.
Hmm.
So, and they do come into Alto Paraíso every year and have for countless, I don't even know how many generations it's been going on, but they do come out of the Amazon jungle into Alto Paraíso, and they do ceremonies every year. That's, you know, they migrate in every single year. So it's very, very possible that that's how they, that is how they got there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great stuff. It's really great stuff. The more I dig into it, the more I'm finding myself in the middle of a Grail quest.
Yeah. It sounds like there, I mean, what are some of the biggest mysteries that you're still trying to solve? Top of your mind, what is the big question for you that you're going, well, if I could just find the answer to this, then this would connect that dot together?
Well, a lot of people have become very interested in my quest. Both in Portugal and in Brazil, the current Templars, Masons, a lot of people are very, very interested in what I'm doing. And they think that, several of them think that I'm going to find the Templar treasure at some point.
Now, what is it? I've heard various things. I mean, my grandfather, who was an ancient historian, an American historian, was interested in the esoteric to a certain degree, but he had a collection of ancient antiquities and loved all that kind of stuff. I once asked him about the Ark of the Covenant, and he told me that the Templars had that for a little bit, and it was in some castle in Europe. I mean, I don't know if you've heard that, but first of all, tell me about that. Do you know anything about that?
Absolutely. Yes, I found a very interesting connection with the Templars in Tomar, Portugal. They entertained the king of Ethiopia.
Okay.
And the king of Ethiopia came back and forth between Ethiopia and Tomar, which is the castle and was also the stronghold for the Templars in Portugal. Back and forth. And the Templars also went there into the Ethiopia. They built some, there's some buildings there. There's some temples there. And I'm actually, that's one of the places I'm going to be going, is into Ethiopia myself. There's a small town. The name of it has just escaped me. But the rumor is that the Ark of the Covenant is being held there. And it's been there since Solomon and, you know, the whole story, Solomon and Sheba, the Queen of Sheba, they had a child. When the child came in back in to meet his father, when he became of age, Solomon was, you know, getting ready to die. He gave the Ark of the Covenant to his son, who took it back into Ethiopia. Now, if this is true, which is very plausible, it's very, very possible, then somewhere in Ethiopia, I wouldn't say that it's necessarily in the temple that they say it is, as otherwise, obviously, those that are in power in this world, they would want something like that.
Yeah.
So I think that they're still keeping it very well hidden. But the fact that the Templars were involved with the king of Ethiopia from that region leads me to believe that they knew. They have some sort of plan in place for a future time that I think all of these things are going to be exposed to the world when the time is right. And that's my belief. And that's what I saw in my near-death experience. I saw a time in the future where things changed. We went through transfiguration as a world community. Everyone went through a raising of consciousness, and it was literally a transfiguration. I think that the Templars, that this was their agenda, to bring about a better world, a world of equality. Not many people know, but that when they created Portugal wouldn't exist if it hadn't been for the Templars.
Oh, why is that?
Well, because they were the ones that went in and basically cleared the property for royalty, you know, for the first king of Portugal to come in and create a country. They were the ones. They fought the Moors. They fought Islam. Everybody who had, you know, had property in that area. They had castles in that area. But what they did after was what was interesting. They invited them to stay, along with the Cathars, the Jews, Druids, and Christians. So what they created was a sovereign nation of equality.
Wow.
During the time that the Catholic Church was trying to wipe out all these religions and esoteric belief systems, all the Gnostics beliefs, all of that, they were trying to wipe that out and bring in canonized Christianity, according to Constantine, you know, who changed everything, and everything went into, you know, these canonized Bible. And they wanted everybody to believe that. That's what they wanted. So Portugal was getting away with this in 1100 all the way up to the 1500s.
Yeah.
No other country in Europe was able to do this. This was only because the Templars had a tremendous amount of power in Portugal. Portugal, and Freddie Silva and I have discussed this. This was his baby. He discovered that Portugal, Port of the Grail.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Portugal was created for the people of the Grail. Basically, what the Templars believed were, you know, people that could live in harmony with each other. And, you know, and I think that when they became threatened in 1307, when Philip IV came in and annihilated, you know, rounded them all up and rounded up Jacques de Molay, like everybody knows. And 7 years later in 1314, he murdered the ones that he still hadn't got in prison. But the Templars, this is when I think that they went to Brazil.
Interesting.
In 1290, the writing was on the wall. In 1294, they lost Acre. They were no longer useful as a military order in the Holy Land because all the kings were calling them back into Europe because they were broke, spending all this money on the Crusades. They were all broke.
Right.
France was broke. They were broke. So the Templars find a cave in Brazil, and several was when I found out that they not just found one, but several that were gold mines. It was perfect timing, right? Perfect timing to fill the coffers of King Denis in 1314 and, you know, and during that time frame, but also so they could move out into other territories, North America, South America, and recreate what they had already started. Now, the interesting thing, when you go into Alto Paraíso or Moinho or San George, and if you notice, San George, Saint George, is a very important saint in the Grail Quest stories, all of them.
Right.
Anyway, when you go into this area in Cavalcante, there's four little towns surrounding the area where the cave is. There are people from all walks of life, all religious, all cultural backgrounds, economic backgrounds that are all living together in harmony. I don't think that's
Whoa.
an accident.
Yeah.
I don't think it's an accident. People are drawn to this area. They're drawn to this area. You walk down the street and you'll talk to 10 different people from 10 different countries. And they're all living there in harmony with each other.
That's interesting. Do you think it is? I mean, do you believe there's any kind of ley lines going on there?
Yes.
Is it is a active energy grid?
Absolutely. My first trip over there, when I, like I said, when I went for that healing with John of God, I met the two, both of the town shamans, one of whom sent me on a spiritual quest, a little mini quest to go to three of the spiritual healing sites and do meditations. And I experienced a tremendous, energetic download, I guess you could call it, at all three sites.
Wow.
So I know that there is a tremendous amount of energy in this area. It's just the powerful, powerful. It's palatable. Anybody who goes there will tell you they feel it. And anybody. My daughter came to visit me with her girlfriend in September when before I came back on this last trip, and they felt it. My daughter's not open really to that kind of thing. Neither
Yeah.
was her, especially her girlfriend, and they felt it. They even felt it. So it's palatable to anybody who goes there.
Yeah.
And I think that, what the locals believe is that the Templars laid a grid, a sacred geometry, magic is what they call it, that have drawn all these people into this area. Essentially, they're drawn to the energy that's there.
Yeah, this is what's interesting about this story. I mean, I and Dan Brown hints at it by referencing Manly P. Hall, who talked about secret teachings of all the ages, and then that there's just so many people talk about these esoteric traditions if you ask about them and research about it, but it's not mainstream. That's what's controversial here. This is our history. This is ancient history, but no one's really talking about magic because it's primitive. It's something that we don't believe in, and yet there are people who still practice this and have spiritual experiences in these areas, and people feel different in these areas. In your research, when it comes to, I guess, giving weight to the esoteric, giving people out there that might be more skeptically minded, something to chew on, what have you found in your research here that makes you go, that beyond even your own experiences, that make you go, yeah, there is something here that is from a higher level of consciousness.
Well, there, all you have to do is walk it out into, out into the forest. I mean, I happen to be in my house in Boulder Creek right now, and all I have to do is walk outside. And there's no doubt in my mind that there had to have been a God. There had to have been something that created this amazing harmonic beauty that we have all around us. There's just, that's unmistakable. So I have a tremendous faith in a creator that has a plan, and I
Yeah.
believe that there is a plan. And I believe that, what's going on in the world today, we have some really power hungry authoritarian sources, that are leading countries, whole countries are involved in. And I think it goes beyond that. I think we have possibly a group of people who have been running this world for a long time for their benefit.
Yeah.
I believe that that's true. I've seen too much evidence that points in that direction. But I also believe that this is a time that people are also waking up, because people are waking up left and right. I can go into a coffee shop in any country. I don't, I'm, and I have in every con. I've been all over the world.
I was going to say, it seems like you have. Yes, I believe that.
And have this conversation that you and I are having right now about spirituality, about what's going on, about a change of consciousness. They feel it. Something is shifting. Something's changing. And these are doctors and lawyers and housekeepers and mothers who stay at home and, you know, businessmen, just random people. They're all talking about this. They're all talking about something's changing. Something's different. They can't put their finger on it, but they just know that something's coming. They feel a sense of uneasiness that because they don't know what the unknown is going to be, but they do believe it. Almost everybody I've talked to believe that something's changing, something, the world is going through a transformation of some sort. And that for me is huge because I couldn't have that conversation. When I had my near-death experience in 1990, in March of 1990, I couldn't even mention that. Nobody had any information about that.
Yeah.
And anybody who did was very skeptical about your story, you know. I think it was 10 years before I actually discussed that with anybody, you know, other than just my, you know, my private group of researchers and people that I was working with. But that was just not something that you discussed. Now, everybody's talking about it, you know.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's very mainstream.
One out of five people have had, or they know someone who's had a near-death experience. So what's up with that? You know, I mean, that's a pretty big deal, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's proof to me that there is something going on with the consciousness. And everybody that I've talked to that's had a near-death experience, they all talk about a shift that they believe is getting ready to happen. They saw something. They saw humankind is, you know, all united, all equal. I get too many of these stories to think that that is not connected, because that's basically what I saw too. A future in our world and mankind that we've gone through a transfiguration, that we went through and evolved to a higher state of consciousness. And, you know, I just hear it too many times for that to be, what is that? That's just not isolated. It's not an isolated experience. It's a shared experience by hundreds of thousands of people.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that right there is evidence.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. There is definitely it's hard because we've had this idea for such a long time that the only proof is the scientific method, that this method of research is the way that we define knowledge, and it completely discounts the entire nature of the human experience, I believe. I mean, there are things, why are we so presumptuous to assume that we have the straw? We've figured out the way to determine what's real and what isn't, and in a world where consciousness and these other states of existence flowed in and out of reality, Nothing even seems absolute. People are questioning scientific theories every day. So I definitely see that dilemma. And it's hard to dispute with somebody's personal experience. I can't tell you what you experience with your near-death experience at all. Though I do wonder about this awakening and the Templars, since you said that you believe that they knew this agenda. Did they ever... Is there any kind of evidence or anything in writings that they knew of this time cycle? Because you hear about it with indigenous peoples. You hear about it with the Hopi. They say right now especially is a time the Schumann resonance is going all through. You know, we're getting solar flares. There's a lot going on right now. I'm curious how far the Knights Templar, what finger on the pulse that they have about where we are today.
Well, I believe that they saw into a time that they would return. And I happened to have been in Portugal in 2019 when the Templars, all of the Templar organizations, and I'm not talking about, there's a ton of Templar organizations in the world right now, which is interesting. Because
that is interesting. That wasn't
the case 50 years ago. We did not see this huge expansion of all of a sudden Templar organizations popping up all over the world.
And they're legitimate, most of them, you think? It's not just people claiming the name for themselves. I know that happens with...
Well, some of it is. Of course some of it is. Because we're going to have people that want to be something, whatever.
Yeah, right.
But what I'm talking about is the primary Templar organization. And in Portugal, they claim to still be consistent from the Templar organization that was killed off or whatever, or shut down by the Inquisition in 1500, that there were still some families that kept the Templar secrets and belief systems and practices alive. So that those generations, those descendants of those people today have expanded the Templar organizations. And what happened in 2019 when I was there is that all of those organizations that are affiliated with this particular Knights Templar organization, they all came together and signed a pact internationally.
Oh, that's interesting.
First time in over 700 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Then I found out when I was in Brazil that the Templars have reorganized in Brazil as well.
Hmm.
Recently. Yeah. So is that, is that a coincidence? Is that just simply a coincidence? I don't think so. You know, there is also some rumors about Queen Isabella, who was King Denis's wife, who had told a prophecy of when that the Templars would come back in a future time and they would create a world or bring about a world of heaven on earth.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That'd be great. We need that right now.
You know, so... you know, here we go. And so what's that going to look like? None of us really, or, you know, everybody's all afraid of this one world order, blah, blah, blah. You know, that's the talk now. And I do think that there is elite societies, whatever you want to call them, that would like to see a one world order that they're in control of come into existence. But I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think that it can, because why? It's not in God's or our Creator's evolutionary plan.
And the Templars knew that, you think?
Yeah, absolutely. If they were anything, they were devout, spiritual group, the inner core of them that believed in a creator and they believed in an evolutionary plan. And if they were nothing else, they were definitely that. And I think that, you know, they probably had access to certain relics and information. You know, we have evidence now that they were, not only did they build a stronghold in Jerusalem right over the top of the Temple Mount where the stables were, but they also were excavating under the temple into the tunnels underneath where the temple was. We know that now. There's evidence. They found Templar artifact down in that area, so they know it beyond a shadow of a doubt. So the chances of them coming up, you know, with artifacts, with genealogies, with who knows, you know, are very good.
Yeah, very good. This is interesting because it does make me think when you talk about the New World Order, I think this is just a mistake that people could make very easily. I know I certainly have done it, is that when I think of Rosicrucians, when I think of the Templars, when I think of the Illuminati or the Masons, sometimes it can all be lumped together. It's hard. You know, whenever you hear mysterious secret society, and I always think it's a little bit sort of what you were hinting at before. They're different factions of these groups, right? So it's never, well, everybody in this secret society is evil, and it's never everybody's great. But when I've become very pro-Templar in this interview, because it doesn't seem as if... You know, I don't know if I can trace the Rockefellers and J.P. Morgan to a Templar organization. If anything, it sounds as if, based on the things I've heard about those other groups that may or may not have ties to Skull and Bones and secret societies, the Templars were trying to be an antidote to some of that evil. But, you know, knowing that there is a lot of stigmas about a so-called secret hand Illuminati, people controlling the world that have been doing it. How would you place the Templars in light of that?
Well, the Templars, I believe, like I said, they were interested in creating a sovereign nation in Portugal. I think they wanted to expand that out to the rest of the world. I think that's why they traveled to North America. I think that's why they traveled to Brazil, was to recreate the New Jerusalem. They were also in Scotland and you know, in Edinburgh, that particular area where Stirling, where the castle is in Edinburgh, many believe that that was at one time called the New Jerusalem. And that was the Templar holdout. That was their stronghold right there. Roslyn Chapel is, what, 13, 14 miles from that center. And Temple, which is where the Templars stronghold, their actual primary headquarters was right there, which is like right next to Roslyn, right near Roslyn, right near Edinburgh. So I think that, okay, so you got a New Jerusalem there, you got a New Jerusalem that you're wanting to create in North America, you got this Alto Paraíso, which is basically a New Jerusalem, right? I think that they were populating these places all over the world, not only with their bloodline, you know, which all stem back to the House of David, right?
Mm,
if I'm
right
in my research, I think that they were actually populating these nations with these, with this bloodline, and whether it was Jesus and Mary's bloodline or whether it was just stemming back to the House of David, who knows? But they were successful in populating these other continents and other countries. I've even seen evidence that they were in India. There's
Templar
crosses on the coast in India. So, and Turkey. I mean, I've seen Templar crosses all over, evidence of the Templars having been all over the world. So I think that they were really busy. You know, the inner core of Templars were very, very busy in the 11 to 1300s. And I think that they were real busy setting about the foundation stones, if you will, for a future time that they could bring about this heaven on earth. And I think they did it partially by, like I said, by actually bringing in the genealogy and intermarrying into families and indigenous cultures all over the world.
Yeah, I know that that's very interesting that a group of people came into the Americas and didn't decide to just kill all the Amazonian people. It almost seems like they were shaking hands. And I mean, this image that we have of Thanksgiving here in America that has been completely shattered over, you know, the last 20, 30, 50 years in America. People don't even want to celebrate it anymore. It almost sounds as if that was happening just with the Templars. Would you say that? I mean, did they really, these people, absolutely, the Amazonians spoke well of them?
Absolutely. There's markers in Bahia, and there's markers throughout the Amazonian or pathways throughout the Amazonian trails that come into different areas in Brazil that were stones, marker stones the Templars left. And I, when my next trip to Brazil, I'm going to be going and finding those and photographing those. But I just found out that the Templars in Portugal took a pilgrimage along those, that trail, to identify these markers. So that tells me that the Templars were not only did the Amazonian tribes bring them into central Brazil once, but it was a pathway that they took numerous times, enough to where they laid markers, directional markers, so that people after them would find the way. And in order to do that, many of the tribes are They're pretty hostile. I mean, and they have been. They have a history of having been really hostile. What was it about the Templars that they were not hostile towards
That's what
them?
I wanted to ask. Do you have any ideas? Any
I
theory?
believe because I know from my own experience the reason I've been invited into Indigenous cultures numerous times in my life, is because they read your energy. They don't care what's coming out of your mouth. That means nothing to them. They read your energy.
That's interesting. So do we believe that, I mean, is this just something of that bloodline, this because they came from this divine root, they carried almost this angelic sense about themselves? Do you think some of the mystical practices allowed them to radiate more of a glow? I mean, if you were to break it down, yeah, these are just my theories, but I'm curious. I mean, how do you get in with an indigenous nation in 2022 without having them think you're the enemy? That's kind of the remarkable thing about their story. And I'm wondering what we can learn from that today.
And and not only did they welcome me in, but they also invited me into a healing ceremony and healed me. I mean, literally healed me. And I don't know if you know anything about transplant people, but typically, once you undergo a transplant or any type of organ at all, you're on immunosuppression for the rest of your life.
What do they have over there? I mean, is this, I know that South America is often, it has an association with plant medicine. So I'm.
Absolutely. And they use plants. And they, in fact, a lot of our pharmaceuticals come from Amazonian plants anyway. They just,
Made them worse. Oh,
they just
great.
take, right, they just take them and recreate them. They synthesize them, they do all this stuff. But basically, the plants that heal most of the world have, originated in the Amazon jungle. So everything is plant-based medicine. I
Yeah.
keep, oh, well, this isn't, well, that isn't. I don't get into all that controversy. All I know is that what I went through was a very beautiful experience, plant-based medicine, and I now have a healed liver that is harmonious with the rest of my body. My
Holy
immune
moly.
system does not reject this organ at all. So, and I've been off immunosuppression for over 7 months, and I'm being monitored by a medical, Stanford Medical Center. In So they're monitoring every month, sometimes twice a month, all my blood work. So it's being verified by them.
Oh my gosh, everybody thought Harrison Ford, after he went on his trips as Indiana Jones, was a cool archaeology teacher. But we got to get you back in art history. These students would love this. I feel that you are the teacher, Dr. Kathleen, of what we need right now. I mean, my gosh, sign me up for this class.
Yeah, I feel like this information, this is why I wrote the book, because I had a lot of people say, Kathleen, you've got to get this out to people. And I was like,
Yes.
well, I'm not teaching anymore in the, in the college. I'm not teaching in that venue anymore, but I can still teach, in another way. So I wrote the book and it's out there, and I talk about all these spiritual experiences, all these things that have happened. And I think that the reason why I've been able to pay attention and the reason why I've been allowed these experiences to guide me is because after having the near-death experience, I became very sensitive to interdimensional energy and guidance. I've had a number of things happen that are not normal at all. They are not normal.
Give me one of them. I gotta know. Now we have to open this door a little
Well,
bit.
we have to. I mean, it's part of the story, and I'll back up. In 2009, when I went back to France and my husband and I, and I mean, we had no intention. I was not on a quest at all. We were having our honeymoon. My husband and I got back together after 38 years. We were separated. He married someone, I married someone. We had planned to marry when we were in high school. Two people broke us up. We married those two people not knowing what happened. Anyway, 38 years later, he found me and we got married. And in 2009, we went to France for our honeymoon. on a motorcycle trip. Well, the first thing that happened, I fired the woman who set up our itinerary, the travel agent, because she knew nothing about distances between certain places in France. She had no clue. And she had us on this great race. So I said, okay, that's it. We're bowing out. We're going to just wing it. And my husband's like, we're going to wing it? And I'm like, yeah, we're going to wing it. I know enough about travel, we can wing it. So we decided to do that. And so in Dome, France, is where I canceled all those plans. And so the first day, we're in Dome, France. We're going down into the grotto. We're seeing that. We went to an art show. We did all this wonderful stuff. And here I get handed the keys. I didn't ask for those keys. I get handed the keys to the Dome dungeon where the Templars were housed. And when I brought those keys back, the curate said, you know the story about the Templars. You know what they were protecting. And I said, well, I have an idea, but what's your take? And he said, they were protecting the bloodline of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And I said, okay. I said, I've heard some things on that. And he said, you are just in the beginning of your discovery about this. And he said, I can make some suggestions of some places to go if you want to go to other places in France, but many, many people in France believe the story of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, and they believe that there are descendants that are all over the world. Anyway, so the next thing I know, we're in Marseille. My husband and I went from Dome into Marseille, and we're in Marseille, and there's this chapel, and I hear that it has something to do with Mary Magdalene. So I said, well, let's just stop in. I just want to, let's just check it out. So I go to open the door of this huge cathedral, and this nun comes out and she starts hugging me and crying and telling me that she's been waiting for me since college. She learned English in college so that when I came, she could give me a map with instructions and tell me what I needed to do. And she's hugging me and crying. And my husband's looking at me like, what the heck is going on?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I ended up at the place where Mary Magdalene had lived and in intercessory prayer for 17 years on a mountainside, and had an amazing spiritual experience there that was just probably one of the most powerful things that's ever happened to me. So these kind of things aren't normal. These kind of things don't happen to everybody. They just don't happen to everybody.
Yeah.
So, this has all led me to believe that in my life, this quest has been going on. I think I came into this life. I was actually birthed into this life with this agenda.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, are they going to let you be a Templar? Are you one?
Well, is that the big secret? I've actually been invited to a couple of Templar groups, and I'm affiliated with one at this point, basically for research purposes.
Yeah.
But I'm waiting for the right fit, if that makes sense.
Yeah, makes sense.
I have to align with the group on a very high spiritual level. And I know this may sound a little odd, but I keep my physical body completely pure. I don't do any drugs. I don't smoke. I don't drink. I don't do anything. I do a meditation every morning. I do a meditation every night. I'm very in tune with what's going on spiritually and interdimensionally. Very in tune. And I'm convinced that what I'm doing is also, it's definitely a quest, and that I will be revealing something. I don't know what that will be, but I don't know if it's going to be a physical treasure, if it's going to be a spiritual treasure, or I don't know what it's.
Yeah, talk to me about that. We talked about the Ark of the Covenant, but we actually didn't miss that. We missed that point. What is the Templar treasure? Where does that come from? I know I've heard about it before, but can you give me a reminder?
It's a tremendous amount of speculation on what that is. Many, because they were very rich and very powerful, the organization itself. I mean, the knights lived very poorly. They didn't, you know, they took a vow of chastity and poverty, you know, to become Templars. So it wasn't about them. It was about the group. It was about the organization itself and what it could offer the world. You know, they brought in banking, not the banking that we have today. There's a very big difference. If you study the actual banking system of the Templars, it's very different from what's going on today. It was perverted.
That's fascinating.
It's perverted by the bank system now, but that was not the original method. It was not the original system that was used by the Templars. But the Templars, they had an ideal, a very high ideal. And I believe that their agenda was always for a future time that they could bring about a better world. And I think that's always, it always comes back to that. And in my near-death experience, I saw that. That's what I saw. I saw a different world. I saw a time in the future, and I didn't know when it was. I didn't know if it was going to be 10 years, 30 years, 100 years. When you're in that state, in suspension, in the near-death, you know, state, past, present, future is all going on at the same time. I know that's difficult for anyone who has never had that experience to really grasp that.
Right.
But there is no time, basically. There is no time. So when you come back from that experience, you don't have time markers to say, oh, well, this is when this is going to happen. You just see it in that state. You just
right,
see it.
Right.
And you have a conviction in your heart, in my case, I do, that it's going to happen. And I've aligned myself with that. That is my core purpose, is to see that come about. And whatever way that I'm chosen to participate in that, sign me up. I'm there. I'm willing. So
yeah.
I see myself as a worker bee, you know, I'm a worker bee. Give me the task and I'll do it because I am very willing. And because I'm willing, I think that's why I have the exceptional spiritual experiences that I've had.
So you're okay if the treasure ends up being some state of self-actualization that everybody has. Is that good enough for you, or do you want the gold a little bit,
Absolutely.
Kathleen? Oh, you do. You're good. Okay.
Yeah, if you could undergo a real shift in consciousness worldwide, that would be the biggest treasure that we could ever experience. That would be more valuable than gold and silver, than riches, than power, than anything.
Yeah. I mean, look, I remember reading in the Da Vinci Code, learning about the Holy Grail, and being, I think my perspective did change a little bit at first, because I thought, oh, I was in a period where I was learning what symbolism was. So the idea that the Holy Grail is a symbol, the idea that these great ideas, the divine feminine, I was learning about these things. So I said, okay, that's fine. But it does make me always, now stepping back and looking at it, I'm going, do you believe that that the Knights Templar, that these groups were that literary? I mean, does it map out? Does a Holy Grail being this cup, you know, were they? Do you think the symbolism matches up in your research? Were they about that kind of stuff, or would they have ever meant, no, this is a literal treasure? What do you think?
I think there may be some physical relics. You know, I know that Hamilton White and Carl Cookson certainly have possession of authentic Knights Templar relics. And some of them are actually chalice cups. I mean, you know, they have, I've seen them, you know, their stuff is magnificent. This stuff was supposedly uncovered in Tomar, again, here we go back to Tomar, Portugal, in the 60s. It apparently had been buried during the Inquisition in 1500s. And so it was dug up in the 1960s. And Carl Cookson and Hamilton White bought these relics at some point. And, you know, the Lost Relics, they have a show. It's out on Discovery Channel. So I know for a fact that there were relics. I know for a fact there was probably some very valuable artifacts that make up a physical treasure. But in my opinion, I don't think that that was the real treasure.
Yeah. And do you believe that? Are you just saying that, or do you think the Knights Templars and organization believe that too? That's what they're hinting at.
I think that, you know, that varied with individuals, of course.
Yeah.
That some were probably interested in money. Some were probably, you know, interested in power. That goes with the territory of being human.
Right. So it all comes back to that individual experience. That's very cool. Yes,
but I also do believe very strongly that there was a dedicated inner circle that probably coincided with what I believe, that bringing about heaven on earth was probably more important to them than anything that anyone could have given them.
Yeah.
They were beyond temptation. I know I am. I mean, I know that's a dangerous thing to say, but I can't see myself being tempted by anything at this point in my life. And so I understand. And I think that is a direct result of the gauntlet that I have experienced in my life. My life has not been easy. I've had tremendous obstacles to overcome in my life, tremendous. So, you know, when people say, oh, well, you know, you have everything easy going, you know, now in your life. Well, yeah, I do. Everything is easy now. I mean, pretty much. We have a beautiful home. I have a wonderful husband. I have a beautiful family.
Who are the jerks saying that to you?
What? I do have funding so I can do these things.
Yeah.
Yes, everyone says, oh, you know, and I tell them, you couldn't have lived my life to get here.
I want to talk to these people. What?
You know, I don't think that most people would want to have lived my life where I am today. So, you know, and this is something, pilgrimages were very common back in the medieval period when the Templars were, you know, that was their time frame. And it was very common for people to go out on a pilgrimage. And a pilgrimage was not a walk in the park. The pilgrimage was wrought with challenges. Many people died on those pilgrimages. When they came back, they often came back very changed people. Same thing with my life, you know.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. I see parallels all the time with what I perceive that Templars went through, especially those in the inner circle and the inner core. They literally did go through spiritual, physical, emotional, mental transfigurations to become who they were, to be aligned and dedicated to what they believed in that was coming forth, that they wanted to assist in coming forth eventually in the world, which I believe was a harmonious, worldwide, united, sovereign world. Heaven on earth, you know, I do believe that they were dedicated to that. I feel akin to that because I understand that. And that is my heart's desire.
Yeah. Why even stay in America at this point? I mean, it sounds as if, I know there's violence in certain countries in South America, but does it seem to you that for some reason there's something special about South America versus North America right now? There's a lot. The Mayans, I mean, we have, you know, Incas. I mean, these traditions, pyramids, sacred spots. What is happening down there versus here?
Oh, South America. South America, if you go to Brazil, my husband says, well, because he came in 2018 when I rediscovered the cave, my husband came to you know, finally, because he's not into, you know, third world countries. He's just not into that. He's Well, he didn't, we didn't go to India. He didn't want to go to Egypt with me. He didn't want to go to these places. So he says, I said, well, honey, I really want you to come. You know, I found this cave again. I really would like you to come and we can celebrate. And he said, well, what's this country like? And I said, well, it's kind of like the old Wild Wild West and the 1960s Haight-Ashbury.
That's an interesting combo.
So yeah. And they said, except the people here are from all over the world. They speak numerous languages. They're multilingual. Yeah, it's just a really wonderful place. South America has many places like that. And I've traveled, well, I've been to 5 different countries in South America, and they're all amazingly beautiful. I just, you know, the historical, archaeological discoveries are just out of this world. I've been to Machu Picchu. I've been to Nazca. I went all through the Nazca lines. You know, I went down into not Choqquequirau. I tried to get into Choqquequirau, which is the sister temple complex to Machu Picchu, but I was able to get into down into Paracas, is where the Paracas skulls, where the
skulls.
Yeah, so I got to see those personally and meet with Brian Forrester, who is the foremost leading expert right now with the Paracas skulls. I met with he and Irene, his significant other, and we discussed, you know, the discoveries of these skulls and what we thought they might be indicative of. And obviously they are indicative of a culture that is not human, 100% solely human as we are today. Yeah. So, you know, it's evidence of that. So South America has a whole lot of mysteries that are coming forward in the last 20, 30 years. You know, a friend of mine was the pilot for Eric Van Daniken.
And oh, wow.
He was a friend of mine, mountain ranch of all places, where my house burned down. So when I came back from South America the first time, you know, I met him through another series of supposed coincidences, right? But he was telling me about all the discoveries that they made. You know, he was the one that first told me about Choqquequirau, that Van Daniken, they saw it when they flew over Machu Picchu. It's not far between Machu Picchu and Cusco is Choqquequirau. They saw it. They actually discovered it then, and they didn't, you know, bring it to the forefront because they didn't want to see the same thing happen to it that happened to Machu Picchu. It's, you know, it's so commercialized now. But anyway, the bottom line is that, you know, South America mysteries are just really in the last 30, 40 years are just touching the surface. I mean, we are just discovering so much, and also in North America. So that's happening in North America too.
I just got
invited Friday, this coming Friday. I'm going to see an area here in Northern California that I think may be very, very, very surprising and very interesting.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, I think we're discovering things here in North America as well. I don't think it's isolated in India. I mean, I saw some amazing things in India. And, you know, I researched the area of Tamil Nadu, you know, which is fascinating. I think that the people in Tamil Nadu may even have preceded the Egyptians. So, you know, with the research that I'm following in that area. So
very interesting.
Absolutely. I mean, this stuff is fascinating. We know just about that much of our history. History
has
always been recorded by the conquerors, by the rulers that have conquered another area. They're the ones that tell the story. And those stories are the ones that have passed down to us through the books and things, because they were the people that were literate, that wrote. They could read and write. So they told us their story. And we have been, you know, we've been drinking that Kool-Aid for thousands of years. So, you know, right now, you know, we have probably thousands of researchers like myself that are out there digging for the truth. You know, I mean, we have Graham Hancock, we have, you know, we have Brian Forrester, we have
Michael Cremo. I mean, legend, Freddie Silva. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned
Collins, you know, we have Graham, there's another Graham too over there. Anyway, there's a whole bunch of people. I'm not I'm not an isolated anomaly, you know, as far as research goes. I mean, there's just hundreds of us, thousands of us. And we're all digging for the truth. We're all digging for the historical evidence. You know, like, look what Göbekli Tepe, you know. Now, it's interesting because Karahan Tepe has just come into the forefront now in 2021. Now, I was at Karahan Tepe in 2019 after my trip to Portugal with Andrew Collins and that group, and Hugh Newman and JJ. We were in Turkey, and we went to Karahan Tepe, and I said, everybody was discussing this. This place is the same. I would just bet anything that this place, if it ever gets our, you know, if anybody ever decides to dig into this as an archaeological dig, I think it precedes. I think it's even older, because I picked up artifacts from Karahan Tepe that looked to me to be at least 10,000 years old. I mean, I'm going to get into all that, but yeah. The bottom line is, so in 2021, somebody decided to, you know, to start a dig at Karahan Tepe, and guess what? It's older than Göbekli Tepe. So, yeah,
there's a lot of history that needs to be rewritten and just written in general. You know, I wish that Alexandria Library didn't burn down, I'll tell you that. But hey, you have access to the Rosicrucian Library. How do you get it? What is that library card process like?
Well, it's pretty fascinating. They have collection, you know, all Mamle Pihal's works are all there, of course. Oh. You know, you can find Blavatsky and just about anything you want. I mean, it's a pretty comprehensive collection. Basically, the reason I go there is because all my books, I had over 5,000 books in my own personal research library. Research that I've done, and it all burned up, you know. So it caused me to have to reach out to other places to be able to do research. And so it's a primary source of research for me the Rosicrucian Library. And I've found some tremendous, tremendous research articles there and evidence.
Yeah.
Pointing towards my theories. And, you know, I'm not one of those people that has a theory and then looks for evidence to fit into it. Of course I do that, but I allow the evidence to guide me. I'm looking for the truth. If I suspect that something might be, you know, it might be something that I would like to be part of my agenda, or something that I would like to be true. If I find out that it's not, I toss it aside and keep going towards the evidence.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what's happening with a lot of people today. You know, I think that that's a mindset. People are just looking for the truth.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you doing it. I mean, everybody has to check out TemplarsInBrazil.com. You can learn a lot. Sign up for the mailing list, as well as learn where you can watch the movie. I mean, it's available on Gaia, and also your book, which is coming out. And where can people find that? I imagine it'll be available.
It'll be available on Amazon, you know, anybody who has Amazon Prime. And it'll also, the link will be on my website, and I'll also have it on my Facebook page, which is Kathleen Ann Ball. And then
awesome.
I also have a Facebook page for the Templars in Brazil.
Yes.
And an Instagram page. So any one of those.
I'll make sure to link to those so people can check it out for sure.
You'll be able to get a link to the book.
Awesome. Awesome. Wait, before we go, I need to know this. You mentioned, I don't want to give away all of it because I know it's coming up, but beyond discovering that the cave was there, things started really getting interesting when you went inside. Can you tell us a little bit about what symbols were there? What was inside the cave that really makes this a fascinating, esoteric quest?
Well, I really can't get into too much of it because it's going to be in the next episode. So,
okay.
All I can say is that I was very shocked by some of the, when I researched one particular symbol that I found in there, there's evidence that it may go all the way back to Sumer.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, it's been attributed to a specific symbol that was used thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago by a very specific spiritual order. So what was it doing in a Templar cave?
That's your quest to tell us more about it. Yes, Dr. Kathleen Ann Ball. Such a fascinating topic. I'm very intrigued. Thank you for bringing this history to us. And I am excited to see what you discover that you didn't even know you were going to discover.
Yeah, I am too. I mean, it's a labor of love. I love what I do.
Yeah, well, thank you for going out there doing it. Stay safe doing it, always. And yeah, please, I'm excited to have you back to at some point in the future to tell us more.
Okay. Well, like I said, I'm going to be going back into Portugal, and there's even a possibility that I may be going to Tibet.
Wow.
Go up into Kathmandu and meet with a girlfriend in May. So
do you think you're the real life Tomb Raider? Not Tomb Raider, but are you Indiana Jones?
I'm a boots on the ground researcher. I go to these indigenous places and I'm a boots on the ground. I'm, camping out sometimes, whatever. I stay in whatever, whatever's available, housing. And, I'm willing to rough it. It doesn't matter to me. I enjoy it. I thoroughly enjoy it. So,
yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing your discoveries. This has been great. Dr. Kathleen Ann Ball, thanks so much for coming on the show. Hey, do you like this podcast at all? Do you like any of this at all? A smidgen? You listen to this and you hate this? That's okay. But if you did enjoy it a little bit, if you could please go to ratethispodcast.com/openloops. And rate the show or leave a review, or just click the subscribe button and leave a review. That helps get this weirdness out there. I'd greatly appreciate it. Until next week, I'm Greg Bornstein. It's been a pleasure. And thank you, Rodney, for the theme music. Take care.